What's happening? Are you in LA?
I am in LA after many trials and tribulations.
I can't imagine what brings you to LA. You going to see Disneyland?
that was a great softball there. I'm here to have more movie talk.
Hey.
Yeah.
What was the nature of your travel nightmare?
Oh, it was I don't know. It seems to me like you would do a lot of traveling, but I know you don't go as convention crazy as I have these last couple of years. Do you do a lot of traveling?
I do. I'd say like I average about a trip a month. So sometimes for conventions, I try and do some I have like my foot in a lot of different worlds. So I do some of the nerd conventions, some of the tech conventions, some political stuff. Like it's kind of all over the place.
Yeah. Like, and so where's your preferred thing? Where have you planted your flag? Who do you fly with?
Oh, well, I'm a little late to the game here in terms of, I now know that you're supposed to pick an airline and you go with them because you get perks.
Well, you know, I'm very late to the game too. You know, when I think it was like, I don't know, maybe 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago, we contacted, because I had an assistant and a little bit more of an assistant. And now I've just got so many people, and a lot of them, run the charity and run the store, but it's fair to say that at least two or three of them are just kind of assistants. And I'd been in contact with Neil Gaiman, and I'd been in contact with his assistant, the amazing Lorraine. And we had her out to kind of say, so you've been assistanting a long time. What are the tricks? And that's one of the ones she told us is like, get signed up for an airline. But it's only been about, probably not 2 years for me. So I'm starting to get like automatic upgrades and stuff.
It's interesting. I'm not sure what to make of this, but in the years, that I've been working on Cards Against Humanity, it's become apparent that, my time is valuable and that it's obviously limited. Like there's only so many hours in the day I can spend doing stuff. And there have been various points during the life of Cards where, me or the company have attempted to figure out some sort of like assistant situation, and we've hired someone. And to a person, like they get what happens is they get hired and then they are so indispensable at doing something that they take that over. And I really don't have an assistant.
Yeah. The same thing. I was talking to Hank Green, and he said the exact same thing, which is he had an assistant and now she's his operations manager.
Do you think we sound like huge tools to everyone listening on this podcast complaining about assistants?
Well, I figure I would prefer to talk honestly about my weird life and sound like a tool than to pretend that I'm living some other life. But I think I know that I've chatted with you a little bit. We've kind of both been thrown into this situation where, I think we're almost like emblematic of geek culture, where we've like risen to primacy without really intending to. Sure, we worked hard, we like had our moment, and we took hold of it and stuff like that, but
slayed our rivals in single combat, so on and so forth.
But I never sat down and made a list of life goals that included like go to Hollywood to pitch your movie deal or be pitched at, depending. But no, it's weird. Like and it kind of pleases me to, because like I've talked to a couple of people, and a lot of them are authors, and nowadays, 10 years ago, if you were an author, like maybe you maybe you had a blog. I mean, well, not like 10 years ago, if you had a blog, you were John Scalzi, and that was kind of it. Well, or to a lesser extent, like Neil Gaiman. And I guess I'm dating myself. I should say like 15 years ago. But, you know, now if as soon as you're an author and if you meet with like a good amount of success, suddenly, you know, just maintaining your social media is kind of a separate job, and writing a blog and going to conventions, and suddenly everyone has access to you. You have fan mail. And, you know, when I kind of started out, I would say, yeah, I got an assistant, and everyone's like, oh, wow, you have an assistant. But since then, like, I know 20 authors who have finally picked up assistants of one sort or another, just in an attempt to like regain control over their lives. You know, somebody to like go and get the mail, to like occasionally run errands, you know, so that we can save some time to do the other, you know, the other things in our lives.
Yeah, I have an assistant right now, Kara, and she's like already, she's been at Cards for like, I want to say maybe 6 months, and she's already too important for me to have her like open my mail or do errands. So today, I came into the office today. I'm actually like, today sucked. Today was like, I came into the office and I had like a day of responsibility where I have been for the last, that was a chuckle of recognition, I feel like. For the last, you know, month or so, I've been putting off like every clerical, administrative, financial, medical related thing in my life. And then I wait until it almost destroys my life, and I take care of them all in one day in like a big anxious marathon.
That does seem like a process of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm alive. I'm not in prison.
It's kind of happened with me too, which is kind of why I kept accruing new assistants. But you know what was what I loved? I love talking with people who are ahead of me in the game, because when I was talking to Hank, and I'm like, and he's like, yeah, I lost my assistant. She was so great. He's like, now she runs operations for me. And I'm like, oh, that sucks to lose a good assistant. And he goes, well, the truth is, he goes, it's way easier to train an assistant than it is to find a person who can run operations.
Right.
And I went, oh, you're right. And that's exactly what's been happening with me too, where, you know, I brought in Maria to like coordinate donations for World Builders. And it quickly became apparent that like she knew how a charity should be run and I didn't. At some point, I think it gets weird where I'm like, I was talking to Amanda and I'm like, do you need an assistant? Because this is way more stuff than, you know, than like one person should have to deal with if they're going to have a regular life and like be healthy.
That's what we have now, is like we have a bunch of people who started off doing, you know, assistant level things, and now they're like managing a big part of, you know, the company or the game or whatever. And then they have like a deputy person, and they have like some people have interns, and then we have like assistants for the interns. I guess I still have this idea in my head of like, I have this problem of the, you know, I have all these dogs and the dogs need to be walked. And if I just get more dogs, they'll all walk each other. Like it'll just be a big parade. Everyone will have some sort of subservient dog's leash in its mouth.
Yeah, it's and what's really important for me to remember is that any really difficult job takes you about 2 years to learn. And apparently that's like just a very well-known, like business precept. I mean, like, sure, it's a little different if you've had a job before or whatever, but a lot of times, like I brought people in and it's not that, you know, now we're doing a better job of like hiring people for like reasons because they have skills. Whereas before I hired people where I'm like, I know you and I know that you aren't going to like set this place on fire accidentally before you leave. Come work for me. But now, you know, we're hiring you know, for a skill set. But even so, we brought somebody in as an accountant, and you know, and he's really good at that. But at the same time, we're starting to bounce stuff off him, like, so, you know, ever, you know, you ever done a profit and loss statement? And he's like, well, not so much. And I'm like, well, you're better with spreadsheets than anyone else here. So now you do profit and loss statements.
I'm only inferring from the context that what that is. I actually don't. I have no idea what a profit loss statement is.
You know, I heard it was something that we're supposed to have.
Okay.
You know, I do that a lot. I like read an article and I say, hey, everyone, it seems like we should have a handbook.
I heard a great one the other day. So, one of the, I think I've actually mentioned this on the podcast before, but there's a company I really like in Chicago called Basecamp. And they are very forward thinking on a lot of things like remote work and just having a really strong point of view in terms of what they're doing as a business and who they're doing it for. Something I've really learned a lot from and just copied them in terms of like running a company. But I was talking to Jason Fried, who is the founder of Basecamp, and he said that they have one of the perks that their employees get is that if they want to pursue a hobby, the company will pay for it. So like if you want to take cooking classes or one person wanted to learn how to become a pilot, like you basically just present that, you figure out what it's going to cost and you bring that to the company and they'll just do it, no questions asked. Because the idea is they only hire really smart, excellent people, and if they learn how to become a better cook or become a pilot or, you know, an artist or whatever, that will bleed into them being a more well-rounded worker who brings better ideas to the company.
I was just talking, you know, with somebody, you know, somebody in our organization likes to do theater. And you know, I know that you dig some of the comedy stuff. Have you ever been in a play?
Not well. I played Grumpy in the Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in first grade.
So you had a taste of it. Well, she, you know, she likes to do theater. And the thing is, like, I have not done a lot of even like community theater, but when I did it in high school, I mean, it eats up your life. You know, you if you're going to be doing theater, if you're going to be learning a script, you got to be there all the time. And you know, we were just talking about the fact that, you know, we're making plans for everyone. You know, like somebody on our team has a book that's going to be published, and I'm like, let's get out in front of this and let's let this person know that we want to keep them as an employee. And if that means we scale them back to a 0.75 position, you know, so that they can pursue this other work of working on their book, you know, that's fine. But let's like plan to be able to absorb that workload somewhere else. You know, similarly, one of my employees is thinking about having a baby. And we're like, okay, you know, that means that person needs to be able to go and be with their baby, and we'll have to be ready for that. And from there, it was a pretty short step to saying, this person, in order to be happy, needs to be able to do theater. And that is such an intensive thing when you're doing it and requires so much time and energy. It's a little ridiculous to expect them to like perform all of their previous job at their previous like amplitude, especially like this isn't, you know, and God bless people who package stuff in the store, but you know, this isn't, you know, like taping boxes together or anything. Like, you know, this person like handles a bunch of things, and you know, I'll call them at all hours, and I'll do stuff like that. I'm being careful to keep names out of this because I haven't cleared with her, like talking about things on the podcast. But yeah, it's an interesting thing, like trying to be a good well, trying to be a good human being, and then trying to kind of expand that into being a good employer. It's kind of weird.
Here's my question about people who, you know, about the people who work in the Rothfuss empire, and this is something like we've, you know, I've definitely run up against. You know, Cards has like such a strong point of view, and editorially, like the eight of us who started the game, like we're still doing all the writing and everything, and it's kind of our show. Like we've sort of set the tone for how this thing's going to go. And at the end of the day, like we get input from a lot of people and we'll take ideas from everywhere, but it's kind of our call if there's a disagreement. And I really struggle with, you know, that I want to create a job that is creatively fulfilling for the really smart and extremely qualified people who come into it. But at some point, Unstoppable Force has to meet the immovable object.
Yeah, the immovable object being the brand, you know. Yeah, you know, we run into that a little bit. For me, in some ways, well, it's different. I was going to say it's trickier, but in some ways it's simpler because it's not a team of eight. It's me. You know, it's like I am ultimately like the ultimate boss. Most of this is kind of built around the books. But, you know, that's not as true anymore. I'm giving people it's really hard for me to let go of things, but I am trying to let go of world builders more and more. And that means I don't write all of like the ad copy myself. I don't write every little entry when we do an Indiegogo. I don't, you know, I've been slowly turning over that. And so the tone of world builders has grown up into its own thing. Which is really, it's the only way that it can work because I can't clutch it like my tendency wants me to.
Like, do you worry about the creative, artistic fulfillment of the people who are kind of carrying out your vision?
You know, I do. And the place that startles me, or not startles me, the place where it potentially scares me the most or makes me the most uncomfortable is, you know, we have somebody working on staff who I've known longer than anybody else there. You know, he critiqued the very early drafts of my book. He critiqued the book that came before The Name of the Wind. You know, I met him in college. He illustrated my humor column when I was working at the campus paper. And we brought him in because he was languishing at Target.
Wow.
Well, and the thing is, like, you know, honestly, I can kind of see the appeal of the Target job. And it's not like he hated it. I mean, Christmas sucked. But, you know, I mean, he went in and he did his job and he was good at it. And then he went home and, you know, did whatever he wanted. But he was a great writer. He was a great artist. He's a clever person. He's great at fixing things and figuring things out. And so finally, when we started to offer health insurance, I'm like, it occurred to me that like that was the main thing that was keeping me from like really trying to pull him away from Target, because, you know, he has a wife, and to say come work for me means give up your health insurance even if you're making more money. So you know, I brought him in, and so he still does this great art for a bunch of our different projects. And it's tricky because when it was like him just illustrating my column, you know, he would do something and I'm like, oh, that's hysterical. That's not what I thought, but yeah, let's do it. But now when it's a part of this, like, you know, of my world, or if it's part of world builders, or if it's part of a logo, I feel like I'm stepping on his creative dick all the time. You know, because I'm looking to achieve a very particular thing to a purpose. And, you know, I love what he does artistically, but, you know, I'm more function and he's more form. So I worry that he might feel, you know, underappreciated when it just couldn't be farther from the truth. But yeah, I think giving your people enough space to like have happy, productive lives is really important. And it's tricky for me because when, you know, running a charity, you get really passionate people, and sometimes things are really busy. And if they're passionate and if things are busy, people tend to burn up parts of their life at work. And that's really great for the charity, but it's really not great for the people. And of course, that's how I live my life. You know, I set 80% of it on fire to get things done. But I don't want my people to do that too.
Yeah, do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah.
And it's totally the same thing. We're getting ready to launch this big new like shipping project, and our lead developer, Scott, has just been like, he's a new kid in the family, and he has just been killing himself working on this thing, and it pains me so much because it's really, frankly, one of the few times in the company where, you know, normally in this situation I'd be like, you know, let me do it, or let me help, or like, let me step in and do this. And this is, it's just over my head. Like I'm just not a developer of this caliber. Like I can't contribute to what he's doing. And it's very frustrating. So we were talking the other day and I was like, are you sleeping? And he's like, well, what about you? Have you slept? And I'm like, I haven't slept in 5 years, but that's me. Like,
right. You've dug yourself such a rut.
Yeah. I'm President Nixon and the law doesn't apply to the president.
You know, you want to know how I knew my team was developing the right way? They said, what was it? I said in a meeting, it's one of the projects that we all needs to get done, but it keeps getting pushed off for more urgent things.
Yeah.
And it was like developing the new website for like my personal website, the patrothfuss.com or whatever, the one that people go to for my blog. And it's been outdated almost since it came out, you know, because I didn't know what I was going to do on my author page. And then it quickly became obvious that it was mostly going to be a blog. But as a blog, my webpage, it's a mess. It's not quite GeoCities bad, but but it's pretty obviously like 7 or 8 years behind the times. And so I said during the meeting, I go, okay, here's the thing. We've talked about it before, but I'm just going to say this. If I don't have a new website by the end of the year, I will fire everyone. You know, and they kind of look at each other and I'm like, it's the only way this shit is going to get done. So I can't spearhead this project because obviously I suck at that.
You should try telling them they need to give $100 to Scott Walker if they don't do it.
Oh God, that would light a fire into their asses.
Yeah.
But no, it's what I said. I go, if we don't do this, I want this to be a priority and I will fire everyone. And they know that I really won't. And that's the problem. But it really underscored it. But then 2 weeks later, we had another meeting and they said, so you don't have a will, do you? And I'm like, no, I've been meaning to do that for a while. And they're like, you need a will and you need to figure out where your IP goes and who controls it and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, I've really been meaning to do that. And they're like, and you have two kids, you know, and you and Sarah aren't married. And that means that she doesn't have the normal legal protection. And I'm like, yeah, I really mean to. And it's one of Neil Gaiman's really big things that he pushes is for creators to assign the disposition of their intellectual property. It's really important. And a ton of authors don't, and it creates a huge mess. And so I'm like, yeah, okay, I will. I'll do that. And then Amanda nudges Maria and says, say what you said to me. And she goes, I don't need to. And she goes, say it. And Maria says, if you don't do that by the end of the year, you're fired.
So I never, we got so sidetracked. What happened with your flight? It sounds like it was a disaster.
So what happened is things got really screwed up. I was going to fly out on Thursday to have a meeting on Thursday, but then due to mechanical problems, the flight was delayed from 9:30 to 10 to 11 to 12 to 1 to 4 to 6. And I'm like, well, okay, I can't make it. We booked another flight, but it was in a different terminal. At that point, I was in Minneapolis. And then I ran my ass off. I found out that there's a second terminal in Minneapolis that you have to take a light rail to get to, and missed that one because you had to go through security twice. And so then I'm in Minneapolis. I can't make my meetings. We reschedule things. I drive up to my family vacation, which I started to blow off so I could go have these meetings in a timely fashion. So I only lost it, but I lost a solid day, you know, doing that. I got up at 5 a.m.
Ugh.
And, you know, and then I managed to get back to my family at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
And this Sunday, so we rescheduled everything for Monday and whatever. And so I got up at 5 o'clock this morning, got in the rental car, drove back to Minneapolis. And instead of having my direct flight to LA, which is the reason that I was I drove to Minneapolis so I could just have a direct hop. I got routed through Seattle.
Wait, you got routed through Seattle?
It was that, or take a flight at 9, left at 9:30. But what's so galling, right? What's so irritating is I'm in the airport. I'm like, Amanda, I call Amanda. I'm like, I've missed this flight. There's nothing else. And I'm like, is there really, really nothing else? Can you get me to San Diego and then I'll rent a car and I'll drive up to LA? And she's like, no, there's nothing at all. And so I'm like, okay, fine. And she goes, take a picture of your baggage claim stub and I'll track it and I'll call Delta so that when your luggage shows up there, they'll hold it and nothing weird will happen. And so, and then what happened is my bag made it out there.
How did your bag get on the flight?
I have no fucking idea. I would like to be, dear airlines, right? Could you please offer us an option to upgrade our status to that of baggage? Because quite frequently I am left off these planes or told that the doors are closing or told, oh, we oversold it. And my bag makes it where I'm going. And I am left in fucking Hoboken to sleep in a hotel.
But Pat, that's society. Like, this is capitalism, right? It works for things. It's all built around things and making great things and getting them from one place to another. And if it sometimes it works for people. If it does, that's a great bonus, but not primarily.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, and honestly, I'm over it. I'm here now. But if I was still in the place where I would occasionally write like a fun, screedy blog, you know, I would write a blog saying, you know, you ate up the entirety of my Thursday. You know, my time is worth money. I was going to be with my family and my children, or having some pretty fucking important meetings in LA. And like, don't think that I don't realize that that makes me sound like a total douche too. You know, it's like, hey, I've got to talk with Hollywood people in LA. You're making me miss my meeting.
Do you ever get that when I get really mad at a company, like, you know, something goes horribly wrong with an airline or whatever customer service thing, like I will have my tweet drafts open and I'll have the, do you have any idea who I am and how many Twitter followers I have? Like, I'll have it all typed out and then I'll be like, nah, I can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. I once threatened to actually, in the middle of one of these things, I tweeted at United and I said something like, United, you're egregious fuckers and I will destroy you. I'm in one of those hotels that makes me feel like a failure for not snorting cocaine off a hooker's ass. do you get that? Where like you booked into this really nice hotel and you're like, oh fuck, I'm not like drinking a fifth of Jack and like throwing my TV out the window. So I'm obviously doing something wrong.
Anytime I'm in a hotel, all I can think about is that everything in the room is just covered in semen and feces. this is how I travel now. I take a little, I found, I think at like Target or whatever, they have in the travel section, they have little travel bottles of Dr. Bronner's, of the peppermint Dr. Bronner's.
Oh, yeah.
And I travel with my own personal Dr. Bronner's now. And when I get to, it's really like the only thing at the hotel. I feel like if I scrub myself with the Dr. Bronner's, it's the only thing strong enough to wash the hotel off of me.
one life, one spirit, one hope.
Yeah, it's great. It's great toilet reading. Totally crazy.
That don't know, Max will probably link in to Dr. Bronner's. One of my jobs, I worked in a natural food warehouse. And so, yeah, we would all read the Dr. Bronner's soap.
On the Dr. Bronner's bottle, which I've spent a lot of time in my life reading, they, in one of the very small fonts, they recommend, the good doctor recommends that you take a hot washcloth. So you take a washcloth, right? You fold it up, you put it under the hot water, you let the hot water run on it for a few minutes, full, as hot as it goes, all the way, steam should be coming off of it. And then you take 1 to 2 drops of Dr. Bronner's, it's very strong peppermint soap, and you put it on the washcloth, and then you wring it and get all the water out, and then just lie down in the bed and put it on your eyes. Really, nothing could be more relaxing or soothing than that.
You know, you're kind of selling me on it. We all, I take weird equipage with me on these trips now, just because, I mean, a lot of times, if I go to a convention, it's not so bad, but I travel a lot to like book signings. And I'm so tired of like trying to find food at 2 in the morning. You know, and I'm guessing that doesn't happen quite so much with you doing the things you do, but like I remember, like I think it was me and Gaiman. He was somewhere and I think he said, you know, well, okay, home from the, you're back from the signing. Room service is finished for the night. I guess I'm eating 5 candy bars for dinner. And him and me and Will Wheaton shared like the saddest like hotel room stories with each other. You know, the fact that like, yes, I have made ramen in the coffee pot. I carry ramen with me now. So I go to this like posh freaking hotel where everything is all, I don't know, stone and chrome, and I'm like at 2:30 in the morning watching Adult Swim and eating chicken maruchan ramen out of a coffee pot using a pen as some sort of utensil, you know?
Now, you know, there's, you know, when you're in a major United States city, there are applications you can put on your phone and you push a button and food comes right to you.
You know, the reason it's gotten laid on me is that I've just like socialed it up like beyond what my body can tolerate, either signing books or doing whatever. And so like venturing out into the brave night too.
Yeah, but that's the life though. Is you go back, you slink back to your hotel room and you go on Grubhub and you shame eat, you know, an entire whatever, because the order minimum is always like enough food for 3 people. So you just shame eat, you know, an egregious amount of food.
I've never run into the expression shame eat, but
You know, yes. It pretty much explains itself. It's like you eat like an entire, you know, bucket of chicken wings, and then you just leave it for housekeeping, like someone ate a baby in their room. So every week on the podcast, we're making some sort of goal for ourselves, for our lives, to try and fix, you know, a decade of negligence and not taking care of ourselves and developing really bad habits with like 3 weeks of quick fixes. So is that, am I wrong?
That's a pretty good way of putting it, actually.
Yeah. Here's our ones so far. So they all stack. We have to do all of them. And then if we don't do them, we have to give $100 to Scott Walker for president. So from week number one, have you made any progress on using like a proper alarm clock instead of your phone?
I have, although when I travel, I do default to the phone just for lack of wanting to pack a separate alarm clock.
You can do the wake-up call.
I do. At this point, because I've been burned with hotel wake-up calls, I always do a backup. So I do phone and wake-up call.
There you go. I've been – my alarm's been fine. I can't say it's made like a huge change in my life, because I still – I like stagger over to my little like home office. You know, it's just like a couple go through the kitchen, go into the home office and get my phone immediately upon waking up. So I can't say it's been a huge change, but I guess it's nice. I get like a nice 45 seconds to myself.
45. See, I will say, you know, because I will, I haven't been as good about getting up early, again, because I've been at Comic-Con and then I've been doing one thing and another, but, you know, and through different time zones. But I have been mindful of, like, not getting up, because there have been days where I will get up, like, stagger upstairs, turn on the computer, and do email for 8 hours. So, like, I have been good about, you know, when I do wake up, I don't immediately go to my phone. And then if I find myself going to my computer, I actually take a little break and I don't immediately go to the computer. And that has made a bit of a difference, just to chime in with that.
All right. Number two, something we did not really get enough time. We did not really talk about this on the last podcast because we both realized that we were running late for meetings. But we were going to, on the second week, we were going to kind of make a budget. We were going to try and think about a budget for our time. And where that ended up was we wanted to make some more time for the ladies in our life. So for you, you wanted to find some more time to hang out with Sarah. For me, I was going to try and make sure I made time every day to hang out with my girlfriend. Was that was making time for Sarah successful?
It was. It was. I scored some points with it because, you know, I called home saying, let's have date night. And she goes, well, should we do that, you know, when you get home or when we go up north for vacation? And I said, both, because I promised two, right? I promised two times a week. And so I looked like a prince doing it twice.
So one thing I was thinking about to go back a week for the time budget, I'm curious of you what you think about this as one possibly a future thing. You know, I was thinking about how weird it is that, like, I see you now probably more times per year and we hang out more often than my alleged good friends that live in the same city as me, that are like my neighbors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's so cool when we're in the same city or at the same event. Like, we will make the time to meet up, to make it happen. You know, we'll find a night. You know, it feels like a crazy opportunity to get to hang out. Whereas the people here who I could see all the time, I kind of take them for granted. They'll always be there. Do you find that happening to you at all?
You know, I will say yes, but I have to qualify mine. And this one is going to sound a little sad, probably. And I guess it doesn't just sound sad. It is a little sad. You know, most of my people here in Stevens Point, they really have moved away, you know, and some of them moved away a decade ago. Some of them moved away 15 years ago. You know, I still have some friends. But most of my, like, really good friends that I had during college, they all live in other places now. You know, with a few exceptions, but I see where you're going with this one and I like it. Actually taking time to be social with people we like in our hometowns that is not a special event, I think is a good one.
Yeah. Just, you know, for me, it's like, I just am aware of these people who I really genuinely like they're the people I think of when I think of my friends. My group of friends, you know, the people who I'm happy I'm in Chicago because of, and, you know, I do not see them. I do not make, you know, as much time, as, you know, as I once did, or maybe, you know, it was always sort of like a fantasy of this idea of, like, hang out with, this, you know, these people all the time. I don't know. I wonder if that's a thing everyone has, or if that's just my own weird, you know, neuroses.
I think you're absolutely right. It's the same way that, like, you know, If you go to New York, if you live in New York, you never go to the Empire State Building. And I also think it has to do, like, for me, in college, we all hung out together, you know, and we had classes together and you were constantly thrown together with these other people. And that's how you made friends. And then you stuck to certain people and you did extracurriculars together. But then, you know, at some point in your adulthood, it becomes necessary to schedule meeting. And some people make that that transition naturally, and I never have. But no, I think this is a good one because, and you're absolutely right. Like I go to, you know, I go to San Diego and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm going to see the people who hit San Diego Comic-Con and a few people who live locally. You know, I'm here in LA and I, you know, as pretty much as soon as I'm done with this call, I'm going to send out a few emails to like tap some of the people I know that live in LA that I never get to see. But when I go home, I won't do the same for my few remaining friends that live in Stevens Point or close to yeah. Stevens Point. So I think this is a good one. Now, here's one thing. And this is something it's been on my mind all the way up here or out here because I'm going to be doing these meetings tomorrow. And at Comic-Con, as I'm sure you could tell by how I was talking, I wasn't really rattled by any part of this movie talk process. But now things are getting a little more serious and I'm having a few more meetings. And I've actually, it happened just yesterday, where I think I had like a little anxiety dream and I was thinking about it a little more. And it's made me want to call around to some of like the few author friends that I have that have gone down the movie road. And I want to bounce this off of you to see what you think. Because like I said earlier, we both kind of risen to this position of success somewhat accidentally, you know? I don't think...
Is this podcast or is this... Are you asking me for... Is this... Are we done?
No. Let's leave this in the podcast unless it gets profoundly weird.
Oh, everyone's going to hear me screw you. This is where it all comes off the rails. Everyone's going to be like, what happened to that guy Pat Rothfuss?
People will be able to point at this point on the timeline.
Yeah, they'll be like, no, here's the exact minute of the podcast where he took Max's advice and it all turned to ash in his mouth.
So, you know, I think about this and I think, you know, and I can't remember because I was really almost in a fugue state when we talked last time. You know, there's money on the table and money is nice. You know, but I also know that money doesn't fix everything. Like statistically, anybody that's done the research knows that like too much money actually can screw you up real bad. But here's the thing. I'm kind of making the list. In my head, I've been making the list of what can I get out of this? You know, and then there's the list of what could go wrong. And it seems like on the one side, it's like, well, there will be money. That's nice. But it's not a huge draw because I don't have a lot of money needs. You know, somebody said to me, well, wouldn't it be nice knowing that your kids didn't have to work? And I'm like, oh, shit, my kids absolutely have to work. I'm not going to screw them up like that. And so now a slightly more attractive is the thought that even if a really crappy movie or something comes out, the book sales will double or triple or quadruple just for sheer force of public awareness. And that's a bit of a draw, too. But and here you get to see a glimmer of my actual pride, right? Mm-hmm. Because like if you go find a list of books or a list of authors, if you go peek on Goodreads, you know, I think I'm like the number 8 most followed author on Goodreads. But I'm the highest ranked author that has never had a movie or a TV show. You know, if you look at the NPR's like top 100 sci-fi fantasy books of all time, it's like I'm really high up. Like I'm proud of my ranking. I'm something like 18 or 14. But I think I am the highest ranked one that has never had a movie or TV. And like this is a strange, almost like perverse piece of pride with me where, you know, I've had my lucky breaks, but people know about my books and love my books because they love books, not because they were bombarded with movie ads and then kind of, you know, went and picked up the book. So that's just a weird mental hiccup. But I think of these other things, like the dangers of effectively, like, of success, because, and that's actually why I've started getting nervous, where these people haven't just been coming and saying, here, take some money and go fuck off to your writer hole, you know, and we'll make a movie and let's not get in each other's way. You know, these places are saying, you know, we would like your help. You know, this is going to be tricky to adapt and we want this to be good. Like, they're actually saying this, and I don't think that it's just bullshit. And so there's the potential of actually going in and working with them. And that means they respect the creator, they respect the story, and they're trying to do something good. And suddenly, once you have the possibility of legitimate success, then I get anxious. Here's the thing is, right now, I'm just big enough in terms of like being an internet celebrity or an author celebrity that people kind of know who I am, and some people will kind of listen to me sometimes, and I kind of get to go and do some fun things. But I'm not Neil Gaiman. And because Neil Gaiman can't like go to a con and just wander around and like just like look at cool stuff at a convention on the floor. You know, he gets mobbed, and the same is increasingly true with Martin. But even beyond that, like, I can go online and I can occasionally make a silly joke. I can write kind of a funny blog. I can post a little weird cartoon. But if I have a successful TV show, I will be so big that everyone will feel that it is safe and fair, if not their moral right, to punch up at me. Suddenly, I'm the person that everyone can safely take a pot shot at because I can't be hurt. Except, of course, I can be. If this stuff takes off, I do think that it might just like straight up just fucking wreck my life with a success. And that's if it's good. If it's bad, in a lot of ways, I'm much safer because then I get some money and we all laugh about it and it's kind of bitter in my mouth, but the books are still good and more people read them.
Well, and yeah, we get this with, I mean, I get this with cards all the time, which is like when we do over the holidays, for example, we'll send out, you know, last year we had 250,000 people subscribe to our holiday bullshit thing and we sent out 11 gifts. So, you know, what is that? Like 4 million pieces of mail. So, right. That means based on that, you know, a couple hundred people, something went really wrong. Like they typed their address wrong or the mail got lost or something was destroyed or whatever. And we're very good at this. That is an extraordinarily low failure rate for sending mail. You know, it's under 1% for our failure rate. But nonetheless, you have these couple hundred people who are just fucking furious at you. And the human mind has not evolved to have a couple hundred people be mad at you and just brush it off and be like, oh, that's 1%. You know, you feel like you're about to die if 100 people are mad at you because they're about to like burn your house down. It's just it's a bad feeling. It feels bad.
Yeah,
it's an interesting dilemma. I mean, as your friend, I hope you do whatever it takes to, you know, what's right for your family and what's right to protect yourself and your own well-being. As a fan, I have almost the exact opposite desire, which is I want you to make great art and push yourself to a point of discomfort where it's right on the edge and something great is created.
Yeah.
Where it's scary and you have to make something great.
Yeah. You know, and I think it'd be kind of fun. It's easy for me to imagine so many things going wrong. I mean, just, and not professionally. I mean, you know, I think I used the comparison before. You cut these deals and you bring these people onto your team, and the purpose is like you're stacking up all your modifiers. You're like, hey, we've got a good writer, that's +5, and we got a good producer, and that's +3, and the studio is, you know, willing to write some stuff into the contract, so that's You know, that's plus 10. But then at the end of this all, like, you roll a 1,000-sided die to determine success. And because there's just so many factors in play that you cannot be in control of. And so I don't actually worry too much about the monetary or the viewership success of whatever we produce. I worry about the creative success. I'd much rather make something that I'm proud of that, you know, wasn't a breakout international sensation. But then you take even a step back from there and I'm like, you know, if I am out here and they do want my help, then it's like, then I move out to LA and I bring my family, you know, or do I hop back and forth? And so I'm dealing with being on a plane, you know, 3 times a month. Yeah. And it seems like a silly thing where, you know, what I'm supposed to want, you know, like this is supposed to be kind of the brass ring. It's like they want to make movies and stuff out of your books. And so it should be kind of a given, but.
Well, I have, I pulled up this thing. It's this quick story that, Peter Sagal, told one time, that really stuck with me. I think about this story like all the time when I have those moments of doubt of like, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the meaningful thing? Like, you know, is this thing matter to people? Or like, how do I make a decision on this? But I thought maybe this would do something for you. So I'll tell the story as told by Peter Sagal. So he says, this is a story that happened to a friend of mine named Morgan Jenness. When she told me this story, she was a dramaturge. That's somebody who's sort of like an editor of plays, someone who works with playwrights. So the story is that when Morgan was a young woman and she was living in New York, she was having trouble finding herself. She was very uncertain of herself. And for whatever reason, she had become obsessed with Mother Teresa. And this was around 1980 when Mother Teresa was like the epitome of human beings, the best kind of human that there was. And Morgan so wanted to be like or be with Mother Teresa. And one day Morgan read in the newspaper that Mother Teresa was coming to New York City to visit the UN to testify about something or another. And she was such a Mother Teresa fan that she found out what hotel Mother Teresa was staying at and she stalked Mother Teresa. So she's staying at the hotel at the curb waiting for Mother Teresa to pull up. And the car pulls up and Mother Teresa gets out. And Peter says, I remember one detail of the story that Morgan told me was that first all these little nuns got out, like a little row of penguins coming out of the clown car. And then finally, there comes Mother Teresa. And Morgan runs up to Mother Teresa, who was an old woman even at that time, and says, oh, Mother Teresa, I'm so glad to meet you. Mother Teresa, the work you do is so wonderful. And Mother Teresa is very kind, and she takes her hand and listens to her. And Morgan goes on, the work you do is so important, and I just want to come to Calcutta with you and do that work with you. And Mother Teresa kind of shakes her head and says, no, 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 you can't just do this work because you think it's important. You have to do this work because you so love the poor people of Calcutta that you can't be away from them. That's when you come and do this work. And Morgan realized she had been kind of busted a little bit in a nice way by Mother Teresa, and she nodded in understanding. And after a minute, Mother Teresa says, well, what do you do? And Morgan says, well, what I do isn't important. What I do is I work in a theater and I just help put on plays. And Mother Teresa says, you know, there's so many different kinds of famine in this world. In my country, there's a famine of the body. But in this country, there's a famine of the spirit. Stay here and feed your people.
Wow.